Gray Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Gray Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. It is Friday, November 26, 2004, 10:04 a.m. on the central coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on the show, we're talking with Spammer X, author of Inside the Spam Cartel, a fictional character who does a lot of spamming. Published by Syngress, Inside the Spam Cartel takes a deep look at the spamming industry from the inside, with the black hats, and from the fighters with the white hats. We're going to talk to someone who's, well, been a black hat. During the second half of the show, I'll welcome you to join our conversation. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or 1-800-655-5877. You can, of course, get into our email queue by going to geekspeak.org. Click on the geeks. Click on contact us and fill out that page to get into our email. This is Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks John Tracy, owner and operator of FeltonGames.com, and Miles Elam, Java programmer, web developer, and student of American literature. John and Miles, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Before we start talking with Spammer X, let's do some geek news, shall we? Miles, I'd like to start with you, sir.
Here's a very nice piece of geeky news. Associated Press was reporting that Gert Mittring, 38 years old, needed only 11.8 seconds to calculate the 13th root of a 100-digit number in his head at the Math Museum in Gießen, a small town located in western Germany.
13th root? What does that mean?
Think of a square root. A square root is the second root. So basically, a number multiplied by itself 13 times to reach a 100-digit number. He went the opposite direction.
They gave him a 100-digit number and said, find out the 13th root of this thing?
Yes.
And he did it in how quickly?
11.8 seconds.
In his head.
In his head.
Can you even hold a 100-digit number in your head? I can't.
I don't understand how he did that. That is amazing. Is it now? Is he autistic?
I mean,
can he breathe? I mean, does he have the other functions?
No, all brain power is set to this one path.
Well, you know, he is German.
All right. Thank you, Miles, for that amazing fact. So is he in the Guinness Book of World Records now?
No, the Guinness Book of World Records will not hold it because you cannot standardize mathematical challenges like that. Oh. As soon as you say, what's the 100th, you know, or the 13th root of this 100-digit number,
I can answer that in less than 11 seconds.
Right, the first person has to do it in 11.8 seconds. The next person just has to look up what the answer was before.
So they don't do that with mathematical challenges.
Right, so each equation is going to be slightly different, and one might be harder than the other.
Right,
so.
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much, Miles. John?
That's less time than it takes me to type in a 100-digit number. Apple is very happy to announce that it's increasing its market share pretty dramatically, and in large part because of the iPod. Recent research has shown that 6% of iPod users have made the switch from a PC to a Macintosh, and an additional 7% are planning to dump their old PC next time they upgrade their current machine.
Wow.
So, by and large, the iPod is bringing more market share to Apple. And in that news, Apple has responded by making this amazing product called the Apple iPod Sock, which is a knitted sock that you can slip your iPod into. I think it's wrong when a hardware software company starts producing clothing, okay? That's wrong. But there it is.
Or music, for that matter. Wait a second. Thank you, John. Miles?
Intel is quietly adopting AMD's 64-bit extensions for the CPU. Intel, which has long been a leader in the...
is now a follower.
In the desktop processor market, and they had always been pushing the specs. For example, they're the ones who invented PCI... And got everyone to adopt it. They're the ones introduced AGP and got everyone to adopt it. When they added on MMX extensions to the CPU, everyone adopted it or tried to emulate it. This time, AMD has taken the lead, and Intel tried to make their own 64-bit offering and just hasn't had an uptake, and so now they're... Yeah.
They're going to switch over. That's great. Well, it's wonderful to see. I mean, AMD really had that 64-bit architecture out there much sooner than
And
than
it
Intel.
Was very good. And
yeah.
It was... Well, Intel had a 64-bit architecture out first, but it was incompatible with existing software.
Right.
So the power of AMD's offering was that it...
Backwards compatible.
Yeah, it allows you to run existing applications while also allowing 64-bit
That's actually kind of sad that we're still doing backwards compatibility. Of course, the processor would be better if we didn't have to deal with backwards compatibility.
Oh, we're still doing backwards compatibility. I mean, the current CPUs you have now are doing backwards compatibility for the original PC.
Right.
For the original 4.77 megahertz IBM PC.
I read recently in Spectrum magazine that Intel spends... close to $4 billion a year in research, or did last year in research. You'd think that they'd be able to, they'd be able to know that with that that kind of money being thrown out, that people want backwards compatibility with their computers. It's interesting that AMD, I doubt that AMD's entire budget is that high.
But the issue, though, with moving to a different architecture is when you do backwards compatibility, a lot of times you will make some type of trade-off. Like, for example, a much higher transistor count, which translates to being hotter and using more power, or being slower. And so that's one of the advantages to just starting from scratch and going, okay, we're going to make a 64-bit CPU, for example, just, you know, cleanly.
Right.
It's also one of the reasons why graphics DSPs are so fast and growing, getting faster so much at a faster rate, because they don't have to worry about...
Why can't they do both? Why can't they make one chip that's, like, you know, ground up, built 64-bit only, and then another one that's a legacy chip that can run 64-bit stuff? I mean...
Yeah, probably 32-bit stuff.
Probably a lot of development stuff.
Well, you do. That's actually what many processors will do. With the AMD chip, you actually have 64-bit registers. You actually have a separate...
But wouldn't they love to drop all the 32-bit stuff? I mean, and just go to just a straight 64?
Well, I think that's what Intel would decide to do originally.
Yeah, if every single business and consumer said, like, yeah, we're going to switch all our software over,
they make two. They make two. They make one, it's straight 64-bit, only run 64-bit stuff. If you need some serious processing power and you have 64-bit software...
Well, it will really come down to whether Intel will continue running its current 64-bit chip.
Which is the Itanium.
And they actually haven't stopped that yet, so we'll
see. Itaniums are still selling, although they haven't been...
Yeah, software is not out there.
They're not the desktop market.
That's right. All right. Thank you very much, Miles, for that story. I want to remind people, especially Dennis, who's on the phone now, we won't be taking calls until 10:30. So you got ways to wait. Except for, of course, Spammer X, who will be calling in soon, and we'll be taking him and talking with him throughout the rest of the half an hour. John?
There's an upcoming auction for dozens of key web services. There's a company called Commerce One that's in bankruptcy right now. And this auction is set to be held on December 6th. And they hold 39 different patents that are kind of key patents in web technologies. And companies like Google, Oracle, and Sun Microsystems are very worried about this because they're worried that other companies will purchase these at the auction, purchase these technology patents, and then use them to file class action lawsuits or infringement lawsuits.
Definitely.
And you know the rewards for that are from $100 million to $1 billion. So.
Right.
Naturally, they'd be willing to spend a lot of money to try and get these patents.
Now, why would the owner of these patents right now, why aren't they suing right now to try to make money?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Maybe they didn't have that intention when they created the patents.
It takes money to make money.
I guess so.
It costs a lot to run a court case. So
they're looking for a funding of $2 million to try and...
Stay afloat.
Yeah, to stay afloat so that these patents can find a better home. they actually want to try to, you know, they're trying to be responsible. Maybe that's why they haven't, is because they're a responsible, moral company. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to find a way to do this in such a way that's not going to result in a lot of, you know, large lawsuits.
Let me just say that I appreciate what you just said, John, but a company cannot be moral. It doesn't have a soul. So, or even thought process.
Hey, Felton Games has a soul, all right?
That's an individual proprietorship. I like that. But just want to make sure that people understand that. I mean, I strongly dislike the idea of personalizing corporations. But in any case, Miles, your last... Well, no, go ahead, news story, please.
Okay. Witnesses before the Senate Commerce Committee Science, Technology, and Space Subcommittee are testifying to the fact that, or to their statements of, internet pornography is the new crack cocaine, leading to addiction, misogyny, pedophilia...
Who is saying this?
Sorry.
witnesses, clinicians and researchers testifying before a Senate subcommittee Thursday.
Okay.
Mary Ann Layden, co-director of the Sexual Trauma and Psychopathology Program at the University of Pennsylvania's Center for Cognitive Therapy, called porn the most concerning thing to psychological health that I know of existing today.
Sorry. I'm sorry. I just don't believe that.
There's some other
things I think are much more concerning to me. But okay.
Like subcommittees trying to regulate porn.
People find porn offensive? Wow. And therefore they make decisions like that? Wow. All right. Thanks.
In the words of a friend of mine who was pointing out this story to me a little while ago, here it comes.
The attack on porn.
The thing is,
it's so ridiculous
wave.
That a lot of people use the internet, and a vast majority of what's done on the internet is porn. So put it together.
Yeah, the original e-commerce was porn. It's just this
porn has driven a huge amount of the technology on the web too.
Yeah.
Streaming video.
It's this multi-billion-dollar industry that everyone kind of wants to ignore, but they can't because it adds too much to the economy.
Thank you, Miles, for that story. John, your last news story for the day before we speaking with Spammer X?
My last news story is about inflatable space modules.
Good, go for it. Let's hear it.
No, let's Bigelow please. Aerospace, which is Bigelow's guy who runs Virgin Atlantic and all the Virgin records, all the Virgin stuff. He's created a firm called Virgin Galactic and is...
That's a great name.
Got a $50 million prize for the first company that can... make a ship that can go up and dock with these floating space hotels he's doing. They're based on these inflatable modules, which is something NASA's been working on, but Bigelow has really been working on it a lot more, in the way that only a private corporation with a soul can. And he just recently got...
Because he's doing it for altruistic purposes, not to make any money from the venture.
Right, of course not. Because
he wants all people to be able to go into space and have a night. Okay, anyway, he finally got approval... Well, not finally. He got approval from the Federal Aviation Administration, which is the FAA, the Associate Administrator for Commercial Space Transport. Yeah, this is a new, department. They've given approval for the Genesis inflatable module, which is the first module. It's small. It's an experimental module. The second one, which will be called Nautilus, is the full-size module. So now they have approval to have this ride up on a rocket and be deployed in space. So it's the first step towards his 2006 goal of having a habitable space hotel that you can go and visit. So
cool.
Start saving your pennies.
Thank you very much, John and Miles, for the news. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxel. The Geeks this morning are Miles Elam and John Tracy. Today on our subject, on our show, Geek Speak, we're talking to the author of The Inside the Spam Cartel, Trade Secrets from the Dark Side. You ever want to know who it is that you hate so much? Well, we got him on.
That's not loaded.
Spammer X, just to make sure people understand, is a composite character created from hundreds of individuals that were met by the author in the security field, in a spam and security field, if you will, IT arena. Some wear white hats, some wear black hats, and many have moved between the two over time. It is not a portrait of a single individual. And any similarities are unintentional.
Lyle, before you go on,
please.
The difference between white hat and black hat, because I think that's a term that
that's
folks would not have heard before.
Okay, hacker. What's a white hat hacker versus a black hat hacker?
Well, black hat hackers, I think, easier to describe. It's someone who's maliciously trying to do something to a system. They're
a bad guy, hence the black hat.
Trespassing, taking your work, stealing credit cards. Okay. That's an example of black hat hacker. White hat hacker is someone who is probing the security to a system, but not doing it so that they can steal anything from the system, but rather to actually find the holes. And usually they'll look, try to find the problem, and then notify the company, hey, you have this hole, you should fix this.
Kind of like what war drivers do.
Yeah, doing it for the sake of trying to make security better rather than trying to exploit the security holes.
Great. And thank you, Miles, for that description. So now our fictional character, author of Inside the Spam Cartel, Trade Secrets from the Dark Side by Cygress Publishing, our fictional character, Spammer X. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, how's it going?
Thank you for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
All right.
So you're going to go ahead and speak as Spammer X.
Yes.
Which makes sense, because that's who we want to talk to.
Yep.
Spammer X is 22 years old.
Correct.
And you have a moral ethical code, and yet you spam. How do you get involved in spamming?
Well, I think firstly, to send spam, you have to have pretty much no moral or ethical code. why'd I get involved with spamming, though? That's really easy, actually. You commented before that pornography is the biggest thing on the internet. Haven't you guys ever looked at all the people making money off porn on the internet?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
totally. Don't you look at it and say to yourself, whoa, I wouldn't mind a slice of that cake.
Yeah, of course. I've actually thought about it. I just didn't want to be in the porn industry, unfortunately.
You just don't want to be in it?
Right.
No, totally. Yeah, me too. Hey, having my face on camera. but I basically looked at it and I thought, well, what are these families really doing? You know, they're selling this product to people all over the world, and people are buying it. And I still, to this day, I don't see anything that's wrong with it. Everyone's told me, you know, you're so terrible, you're so horrible, you're sending me crap, you know, I don't want this. But end of the day, you know, like 30-40% of the people buy the stuff.
Right.
So I looked at it and just said, oh, what the hey, why don't I try and get a slice of this cake? So I sort of got into like that.
Going back to that stat, 30-40% of people who receive spam will respond?
Isn't it more like...
Bad, huh?
Isn't it more like 4%?
Well...
people click through? I mean, if you send out a...
No, I would say a hell of a lot more. The trick to real spamming, and the trick to sending people spam, is making sure people actually are interested in the spam. Spam's psychological, right? I know, if I sent you spam, and I sent you spam trying to sell you Viagra, you're probably not going to be interested at all, right?
Right.
That doesn't interest you. If I sent you spam selling some new tool from ThinkGeek.com, if I sent you spam advertising maybe like a new book from Amazon, it's on technical stuff, maybe some new science book, something I know you're previously interested in, targeted demographics, understanding what someone wants and selling more geared towards that.
Would you say that... When you're really working well in your career of spamming, would you say that you were at a point where you had a 30% return because you were doing it so well?
Yeah. Some of the best spam I ever sent averaged, I think, about a 32% return.
Wow.
But when you get a percentage that high, usually the numbers of spam you're sending are very low.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a very, very small targeted base, and you're sending them an email, and so many of them are replying, but you just have much less. So then it works well. I mean, you got less spam to send and a higher return coming back. Do you get me?
Yeah, yeah, of course. And that's what you want to do. But does it really, I mean, the efficiency of sending mass email is such that it doesn't really matter what the return is as long as there's a return. You could have a 0.1% return. If you did enough mail, you'd still make a living.
Yeah, yeah. I found out something really interesting from this book. I'd never sent out mortgage spam in my life.
Uh-huh.
I did a bit of research, and I found out that if you sent out mortgage spam, I think my figures were like 1 or 10 million, then it could be even just 1 million, and you had a 0.0001% return, you could stand to make between $1 and $1.5 U.S. million dollars.
Wow.
In revenue, and it's just astronomical.
Yeah.
So it's...
Well, let me ask you, the size of SpammerX's career, your career, how many unsolicited messages do you think you've sent?
Well, maybe unsolicited is a bit of a term you should use loosely.
Okay.
I'm sure these people want spam.
Because they use it.
I'll probably say 100, 120 million, maybe 150 million.
That's a lot of messages. That's a lot of delete. That's a lot of delete. Now, I have taken the stance on spam. I think that's the recommendation of the book, is you don't want spam to be an industry, then don't.
Do you get spam, by the way?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, do you like spammers?
No.
Don't like me.
I'm sure
come on, man, show me some love.
See, it's not you that we don't like. It's just the
product.
Yeah, the product is spam.
We love you. We don't love what you do.
What's your email address?
Yeah, that's the one thing we won't be giving out. Yeah, I get about 100, 100 to 150 spam messages a day. I have a lot of filters.
How many spams do you get?
Mostly, let's see, most lately, I think Rolex watches is kind of the top of the mark.
Mine's been green cards.
Green cards.
Ooh. Got your green card here.
Do you need a green card, John?
No.
Yours isn't.
I did go to the Canadian website and sign up for some stuff.
Viagra, drug stuff. In general, different drugs being sold. Cheap software. You know, Microsoft packages.
And, of course,
let's
not forget the porn spam.
And then there's porn spam. Yeah. I don't get nearly as much porn spam as I used to. So Spammer X, are you... what kind of spam lately have you been sending? Or are you still in the industry?
I'm no longer in the industry anymore.
Okay. Well, then we won't get in that discussion completely. But let's say, one of the things that's suggested in this book by you is that if you don't want this industry to exist, stop answering the spam. Stop buying the product.
Yeah.
Because people obviously are buying the product, and therefore they want
it. Yeah, that's always the most shocking thing about sending spam. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I look at a spam email, I go, damn, who the hell's going to buy this crap?
Right.
like seriously, who needs this? And you find out, well, you know, out of all these people, 200 people needed this or wanted this. It always kind of shocks me as to the amount of people who buy it. If people stop buying spam and they stop supporting it, then the industry will die.
Well, but, when you were doing spamming, were you able to make a living?
Yeah, very easily.
How does that work? Okay, you're not actually providing the product. So how does it work that you send out the spams and then
you get money?
There are replies. Yeah, how does the money part of it work? Explain that a little bit.
Money part of it work. Okay, basically, I sort of go out as a third-party representative or advertising sales expert.
Okay. Now, do companies hire you to do this?
No. Well, it depends.
Okay.
Some do. I have some friends that run some small porn sites, run some, you know, small pharmaceutical companies and, you know, smaller operations where they're happy for any business.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll say to me, look, you know, I'll start a clone company for 2 months. You spam the crap out of it. Maybe I'll give you 40% of all returns. We'll go from there.
Mm-hmm.
So you can sort of do that for a while. But that's sort of not so common. A lot of people now, it's quite a lot of effort in doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So often what I do is just sign up to a company, some like random porn site, some random pharmaceutical company, and just spam it and basically use it until my account's closed.
Your account on the porn site.
So many complaints from my spam that they usually send me emails and spam stories.
So what you're saying is you join kind of affiliate programs where when you refer a customer, they give you some of the money from the referral.
Yeah, totally.
Okay. But it's very common for porn sites. That's how all these links and ads show up in different websites. Basically, any website that wants to try to make some extra cash will put an ad banner for an ad banner on their site for pornography, and if somebody clicks through that, then the pornographer provides money to that person that advertised for them. And you basically join that program, and instead of doing a website with other content, you basically just send mass emails to people.
Well, yeah. The trick behind it, though, is having a website or having something that leads people into it, and then sort of catching the abuse and catching all their complaints, and then sort of filtering off the ones that are actually interested in the porn site to the porn site.
So and then that way the porn site's not getting the complaints and they don't shut your account.
Yeah, exactly.
Do the majority of porn sites not appreciate spammers?
Yes, some do, some don't.
Okay.
I think the large names, and especially the large American names, don't. They make enough money from legitimate users that spam just isn't important. It's too much of a hassle to them.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the little sites, a lot of the East Bloc Russian sites, a lot of some of the European sites, they don't really care. If they're getting money and they're getting sign-ups from somewhere, well, sure, that's good.
Was there a large investment in capital on trying to start up a spamming business for you?
In capital?
Yeah, did you have to buy a lot of servers or put a lot of money down to make a business?
No. You can start sending spam from, you know, having just a desktop, probably a desktop and a wireless card. You could do really good spam. In terms of financial investment, for me, no, there wasn't. I know a lot of spammers who have started with very considerable financial investments,
mm-hmm.
and they get out what they invest. But at the same time, you can do it really, really cheaply.
So can you send out, I mean, how many messages can you send out from like a normal desktop or machine right now with a DSL connection? Let's say you have that from your home. Is that an easy situation to get into?
Well, for starters, I wouldn't be sending out of my own DSL connection at home.
Why is that?
Well, you have real-time blacklists and a lot of services around this world that are monitoring and looking for spammers.
Uh-huh.
And if you're sitting there advertisingly, willingly sending spam from your DSL connection, it's going to take a matter of hours until that connection is blacklisted, blackholed.
And no, it won't receive any mail from you?
Yeah.
Okay.
No service and that uses that spam filter will, or spam service will receive any of your mail. You'll all be filtered. And then you get complaints from your ISP and get...
And then your ISP can get blacklisted. Let me just explain. Blacklisting means that you get your server or service gets put onto a list of servers that are spamming. And then if you have a mail sending program, you know, you can set it up where it'll look at this blacklist and it'll say, okay, don't accept mail from these different people on this blacklist because those are spamming. Therefore, you shouldn't accept mail from them. So to for your server to be on a blacklist, especially if it's a legitimate server that's, you know, a business server that's sending out messages, and unwittingly you're, you know, have an open relay and you're relaying out messages, and you get put onto this blacklist, it's bad because people you're doing business with, suddenly their servers see that you're on the blacklist and stop receiving mail from you. And it takes a long time to get off the blacklist. I speak from experience on this.
It's a real bitch, man.
It is.
Spammer X, stay with us. We'll ask some more questions. Technical. We'll open up the phone so you can go ahead and ask Spammer X questions as long as you're civil. Stay with us.
Yeah.
This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com.
This week in This American Life, having your family come stay with you for Thanksgiving.
It is around this time, 20 minutes into their trip, that my dad starts making wisecracks like, "Boy, kid, bet you can't wait till we're out of here." I find this charming, but so disturbingly true, I don't know what to say.
It's This Week, This American Life, Public Radio International.
That's This American Life, Sunday at 10 a.m. on KUSP.
You're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. If you have questions or comments, the numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Please try to keep it spammer-related or spam-related. That would be wonderful. Again, the numbers are 1-800-655-5877 or 476-2800. This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing internet services including DSL, spam filters, PHP, MySQL. Now with nationwide access, information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning are Miles Elam and John Tracy, and on the phone we have geek and hacker and Spammer X, a fictional character who authored the book Inside the Spam Cartel, Trade Secrets from the Dark Side by Syngress Press. Spammer X. John was just in this little break. We get to chat real quick, and he was just wanted to ask you questions, so please.
What about phishing and scam stuff? How do you feel about that?
How do I feel about that?
Yeah, because I know I get a lot of spam that's phishing spam.
Yeah. Actually, I don't feel so positive about that. I don't think that's actually trying to sell anything. I don't think that's legitimate. You know, if you get spam selling you a fake Rolex, likelihood is if you buy that fake Rolex, you're going to get a fake Rolex.
Right.
And if you get porn spam and you sign up to that, you're going to get porn. I think phishing spam is, it's not really selling anything. And I don't really feel very positive about that.
Do you think it gives a bad name to spam industry?
Yeah, I think it's taking it one step too far.
And what phishing is, I'll just define that real quick. It's the idea that people theoretically will give you information if they think you're someone else. So if you send a message out and you're saying, "I'm Wells Fargo Bank and your account has been hacked, please give your information to me and I will make sure it's fixed," or, you know, the support team will make it sure it's fixed and it looks all good like a Wells Fargo real email, and you send that information and they get account access and then they go ahead and use your financial situation to remortgage their house. That kind of situation, highly legal. And, I mean, an illegal part of spam, definitely, and not something that Spammer X thinks is a good use for spam. You're more you consider yourself a marketer, a marketeer.
Yeah, I'm a marketeer.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, on that note, I had a hacker break into my girlfriend's bank account just recently, and someone walked out of there with, like, $10,000. And it came from phishing spam.
Mm-hmm.
And
don't you teach your girlfriend not to answer those?
Yeah, well, it sort of came from phishing spam on a computer that installed spyware.
Ah, okay.
And she ended up using that computer. And
okay.
But it was just seeing what that did and really having that so close to my life.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of looked and went, whoa. I mean, I never really thought about it before, but, yeah, it's really not good spam.
Do you... It hurts the industry in some ways. Do you currently get spam?
A lot of spam.
What's that?
I get a lot of Rolex spam.
You get a lot of Rolex.
Rolex,
yeah. Well, how did people get your email address, do you think?
The second you use your email address, people are pretty much going to get it. The second you send someone an email, that's pretty much the end.
Why is that?
Well, everything logs your email address in this world.
Huh?
Like, the second you post something to a website, or the second you send an email to someone, maybe they forward that email to someone else, or logs on a server. I mean, there are so many ways to get an email address, and there are so many places your email address is stored, that it's really just inevitable.
We were debating a while ago whether bouncing back a message that was spam, having the server bounce it back after you've already received it, you know, having the headers kind of say that it never got to a target, that actually would slow down the amount of spam you get. Do you, whenever software you were using when you were doing spamming in mass, was it looking for bounces and saying, oh, well, it bounced, therefore I'm not going to keep sending that email address, or not?
Well, I mean, before you would send any mail, you'd do a full verification, or I'd do a full verification, where you basically connect to each mail server and attempt to deliver a message to the mail account. And only mail accounts that explicitly say that they're going to accept that message, I would send spam to. Uh-huh. I would reduce the amount of bounces I would be getting to start with.
Is that important?
Yeah, I find that really important because those bounces have to go somewhere, right? And it's sort of cleaner if I know that the mail I'm sending is going to get delivered, has a higher chance of getting delivered, and I don't have to worry about these extra, you know, extra kickbacks of all the bounces.
Right.
And also, I don't want to be sending 50 million emails if only 10 million of them are going to get delivered. I got way better things to do, eh?
Right. Okay, well, you talked about how it doesn't make sense to send that spam right from your computer. We're going to get into legal issues, too, with canned spam stuck in a second. But I want to know how you get around that technical problem of if you can't get your machine at your home to send spam because of the blacklisting and the ISP problems you'll get, how do you go around sending spam? How does one do that?
Well, this is where the whole morals and ethics things come into it. Basically, have no morals, have no ethics, and just use someone else.
So you just find somebody out there that has an open relay.
You could send my spam for me. Do you want to send my spam for me?
No, thanks.
Yeah, sure, come on. It'll be really fun.
So you basically, how do you find things that, I mean, how do you find a way to send, I mean, I'm assuming most people you'd ask would say no, so how do you find a place that will allow you to send spam through them?
Well, there's actually a hell of a lot of ways to send spam. And you can do everything from renting a service in another country, maybe some small third world countries, China, North Korea, Russia, Estonia, where you can buy basically a spam-friendly service that will send all your spam for you. That's like the easiest way of doing it. Then you've got more creative ways, like all the viruses that are distributed often build their own bot networks and like Trojanized networks between all these virus users. Mm-hmm. The virus and a worm spreads across the internet. Each infected host really becomes an open relay for a spammer, and the entire virus and worm was created for spammers.
Have you ever done that technique?
I've used other virus initiatives. I've never actually launched my own virus for that intent.
Uh-huh.
But that's a really big business.
Yeah,
a lot of virus authors, you know, it's really big cash renting out thousands upon thousands of home DSL users.
Right.
Saying, you know, you can have
if you distribute that sending from all those machines, you're getting a situation where they don't all get blacklisted. You kind of keep the volume low enough where they don't get blacklisted.
Yep.
They're sending messages for you, and you get to turn your machine off and wait for somebody to come in. Okay, well, let's talk about it. I mean, that does sound like, I mean, hacking, getting, you even using a virus, even if you didn't write it, that went over and took over control of someone else's machine, that's definitely getting into that very borderline, or I would say darker side of the industry. Can we talk a little bit about the laws that went into effect to try to stop spamming because people hate it so much? Like canned spam, how much has it affected the spamming industry?
That's really interesting. Canned CAN-SPAM, I think, started off with a really good intent. And CAN-SPAM has the possibility... stop spam, but severely limited.
Really?
But I think CAN-SPAM can, because it adds so much financial grunt behind it that anyone willing to press legal action against this spammer, as long as they have them tracked down, it's just going to drive them into the ground. I mean, you can sue for such astronomical amounts. But at the same time, I think CAN-SPAM's actually been really, really kind of bad, because basically the way any law works, the second you have a law around something, they have to define it. They have to say exactly what spam is. So now we have a situation where spam is being defined as this. So all you have to do is work around it. You know, if you read all the little nitty-gritty of the CAN-SPAM Act, you can create emails and send emails that are fully CAN-SPAM compliant. But it's spam.
Now, CAN-SPAM stands for a bill, January 1st, 2004, the Controlling the Assault of Non-Solicited Pornography and Marketing, or
yes.
CAN-SPAM, that's what came out. And the act took effect, and the world rejoiced. But did it really... I mean, you're saying that basically there's two ways to deal with that situation. One is to ignore the law and try to get around it and not get and be more sneaky, if you will, not get caught. And the other is to just simply embrace the law and say, great, it's giving me a free ticket to ride. All I have to do is send spam that correlates to this rule set, and I'm set.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things about the CAN-SPAM Act was that you have to have a postal address on it where you can reach the person if you decide that you don't want to reply to them, like via the email. You say, I want to unsubscribe, but I have to send you this letter. You see the amount of spam you get now that has a postal address that's either like some weird-ass country or just some random PO box somewhere. Or people are adopting. People are adapting through. They're changing, and they're looking at the CAN-SPAM Act, and they're saying, well, all I need is a postal address for this person to contact me. So that's easy enough.
Before you stopped sending spam, Spammer X, did you have a postal box or something of that effect that would allow you to cheat through the CAN-SPAM?
No, I didn't really care so much about the CAN-SPAM.
Okay. Well, how does somebody get an address that they can be reached at that's not their home address? Because you certainly wouldn't want people to know where you live because of the hatred people have for spammers.
Oh, come on. You can go to another country and open up a postal box.
No problem.
I could just Google search, find a postal box of some guy in Nigeria, and just say that.
Right. So basically, this CAN-SPAM Act doesn't actually say that you have to receive the message, necessarily. It just says that you have to have a postal address that... I mean, it seems to me that you'd actually have to check that mail to be...
No, you have to be able to receive the message, and you have to be able to reply.
Uh-huh.
But when you send the spam out... maybe you have a window of, I guess, a few weeks of people that are going to be reading your spam and seeing your spam.
Mm-hmm.
And out of those few weeks, maybe it's going to take someone a week and a half, maybe even 2 weeks to send a letter to Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
So you've sort of got a time frame issue there. By the time they sent the mail over there and realized, hey, this was spam, you're already gone. You're already out the door. You've already had the money from the product vendor, and you're out of there.
Right, okay.
You need to be very proactive when people are trying to catch spam. And the second you get the spam, they really have to be on their tail.
Mm-hmm.
But really, the CAN-SPAM Act it's young, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it needs to progress, and I think it needs to have additions that will... yeah, it could potentially do a really lot of good.
Something I'm wondering, when discussing spam as a legitimate marketing technique, but then also talking about having used computers that have been infected by spyware, adware, been trojaned, been compromised in some way, because that, I mean, taking out CAN-SPAM altogether, that's covered by existing tort law. That's actually already illegal. Using someone else's resources without their express permission is illegal.
Yeah, that is against the CAN-SPAM Act, yes.
But, I mean, well, outside of the CAN-SPAM Act,
all right.
It's also...
okay, all right.
But
if I was going to be sending mail that was CAN-SPAM compliant, I wouldn't be using someone else's computer for that. I would be registering with another host provider, maybe in a different country, probably in maybe China or North Korea, or somewhere where it's hard for people to talk to me. I'd be using
Right. So you basically use one of these services. Therefore, because that service is providing you a fee, you're not responsible for how the message is being sent.
Yeah.
Therefore, you're complying with the CAN Spam Act.
Well, you can send mail legitimately enough so that you sort of fall in that gray area of, is it legitimate, is it not, is it... But it's not obviously spam, did you sort of get me?
Yeah.
There's a very bleak surrounding area around it.
Right. If you'd like to ask Spammer X a question, or go ahead and ask us a general question about computers and technology, you're welcome to do so. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877.
Getting more on the technical side of it, how do you feel about forged headers? For the audience out there, forged headers in mail messages, when you send an email, it puts a record of every mail server that that email has passed through in order to get to you from the source to the destination. But you can alter those to change what the source
is.
So you can't go back to find who where the person was from or where the email was originally from.
What do you think about those spam racks?
What do I think about it?
Have you done?
Okay, from the point of view of someone who doesn't really give a crap about breaking laws or not, I think forged headers are really cool. I think they're actually really good when sending spam. And I think they can be very beneficial when sending spam. And they actually confuse a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
You can write headers in such a way that no one really knows. Well, no. Average home users, average people sitting at home receive this email. They don't really know where they came from. They look at the headers. Maybe they see a bit. They're sort of, oh, maybe that's my friend. Maybe this is someone I know. They're trying to work it out. You know, anyone technical can sit down and sort of say, oh, this is forged, this is fake. That's just, you know,
but it's hard for the individual, yeah.
And at some levels, you would need someone that was actually had a mail server and could check the logs.
Right. Spammer X, how do you get your email addresses? How do you originally get them? Do you like have bots that climb through websites to try to find email addresses from websites, or how do you do? Or do you buy them from other people?
I think this is actually a really important part of sending spam. As I said in the beginning, when I said like 30-40% of people reply from the spam, like a really successful spam, and you said no, don't you mean like 4% or 0.4%? That really depends purely on where you get the email address from. Now, if you go out and you buy 100 million email addresses from some random website, some random friend of yours, the quality of those email addresses is really, really poor.
Uh-huh.
Email addresses, they're just people on like random websites, like you and me. And you know, I'm not going to buy Viagra. Why are you sending me Viagra spam? But if you really focus on...
honing down your list.
Yeah. Really targeted demographics. Having really targeted advertising. The way I'll do that is sort of where the hacking bit comes into it. I like looking for mailing lists. I like looking for collections of people that identified previously that they're interested in this subject or topic. Maybe, are you on the ThinkGeek mailing list?
I'm not, no.
You're not?
No.
Is anyone here on the ThinkGeek mailing list?
You know, I try to reduce so much of my spam that I'm just not on mailing lists normally.
You know,
but I think at one point I was on ThinkGeek. So.
Oh, okay, you think more of that. But if I got the ThinkGeek mailing list, I would have a big list of people who I know are interested in tech toys, geek stuff. You know, that sort of niche genre.
But ThinkGeek wouldn't give that out.
No, Geek wouldn't give that out, of course.
So how would you get it?
Sometimes you have to be persuasive or just not ask.
Uh-huh.
I mean, basically, this is where the hacking bit comes into it. I do my own security research, per se, and I would find unpublished flaws in mailing list software, unpublished flaws in any software or code that deals with email addresses, and use those to harvest a lot of people.
Okay.
But it's harvesting people that I know what type of people they are.
Right.
Down to, like, people that like midget porn.
Right.
Not just porn freaks, but midget porn freaks, or black midget porn freaks.
So I'm curious now. Which mailing server software is vulnerable? Have you used before?
Which isn't?
My lips are sealed.
Okay. Let's get into other technical things that could theoretically stop spamming quite a bit. Like right now, one of the big things is you can't do mass marketing. Well, you can. It costs money. Mass marketing traditional mail through physical addresses because it costs a bit of money. So you have to be very specific on your target base, and you spend a lot of money doing it. Spam is kind of a different situation. You've got to get around some technical boundaries and some legal boundaries, but in general, it's very inexpensive to send messages.
Yeah, totally.
You know, what about the idea of a technical spec of SMTP being changed such that to send mail, especially to large ISPs, there is some kind of fee in place or some kind of security model where only certain people can send mail to certain SMTP
hosts? Like Microsoft Sender ID.
That kind of thing.
Yeah,
what do you think about that?
I don't think much of Sender ID and SPF. I don't think that type of technology, I don't think that's going to solve the problems. I saw something I posted on Slashdot a little while ago that I thought it was a really brilliant idea. And that was mail being marked with, I think it was an SHA-1 checksum that took like 2 or 3 seconds to generate. And they said, if this message has a valid checksum on the end of it, then the message is legitimate. And that's just so true. Because, one, as a spammer, well, I can't wait 2 or 3 seconds for my message checksum to generate. Right?
Oh, really?
Checksum's different for each message. It's not feasible.
Okay. So it basically slowed down. You'd have to be targeted that when you send 100,000, that's 100,000 or 200,000 seconds. It's a lot of time to send those messages if you have to wait.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. But for you sending an email, maybe an extra 2 seconds when you click send before it actually sends. Yeah, it's no big deal.
Right.
To me, that's so big. So it's using the numbers game against spammers. I thought that was really brilliant.
Which is nice because it doesn't restrict anybody from sending any messages they want. It just slows people down, so that it becomes inefficient.
And would actually encourage people who did more targeted marketing rather than the big blast.
Yeah.
That's true.
You know, I got to admit, I actually wouldn't mind stop getting things, you know, Calais and Viagra and green card stuff, and, you know, get more things that are targeted toward me. I'd be actually more okay with that. One thing I do want to point out that spam actually shows one of the good sides of the Internet. If you're a small business like I am, to get advertising in a newspaper, on the radio, on broadcast TV, anywhere like that is hugely expensive. Whereas, as Spammer X is talking about, you can go set up a spammer for not much at all, and you can buy mailing lists for, you know, targeted mailing lists for not much at all, and get results from that. So as a small business, it actually does give an outlet for your advertising. Whereas,
what is your small business?
It sells lead figures. We sell miniatures and gaming supplies.
Okay.
There, see? No, I just did a commercial right there. So there is kind of that conundrum of, yeah, this is kind of the cool thing about the Internet is it gives every person a chance to get out there. And I think if you had an opt-in list, that's a great way to get your information out there. Opt-in means you go to a website and you sign up and say, oh, yeah, I want the newsletter about that.
But, of course, if you had an opt-in list for FeltonGames.com, the only people that opt in were people that visited Felton Games and therefore already saw your product. So you really want somebody like SpammerX marketing for you, going out there and finding illegal databases of people's email addresses. SpammerX, do you receive much spam? Like, what's your count right now do you think you get?
Count right now. I have about 6, maybe 8 email addresses, and I probably receive
6
all my spam filters. Because I have heaps of spam filters.
Okay, so how much gets through, do you think?
Probably like 50 or 60 all up.
Okay.
Now, all my accounts.
Does it upset you that you got to go through there and erase spam messages?
Or do you look at them and you go, oh, these amateurs?
No, I hate spam. I feel so violated. I think it's just, you know, the worst thing in the world. I mean, I'm totally with you guys. I mean, why are you sending me this crap? I don't want this.
Right.
Yeah. I actually complain quite a lot. I send out all the abuse emails and stuff.
You do?
Yeah, I do.
That's fascinating.
I
know.
Seriously, you do this? You do?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Why? Trying to get rid of competition?
Damn spammers. Yeah. I mean, I know it works. I know that if I complain to the right person, I can get that spammer shut down.
Oh, really? Okay,
you're like the best anti-spam person out there, because you know
yeah,
the answer.
Totally.
Wow.
So have you thought about going into the business of providing anti-spam? I mean, I personally would probably buy a service if I knew someone would go and try to stop my spam. If I could get someone to stop my spam and give them $4, and I mean a month, right, and actively go out and attack people, and you get like 150 customers like that, couldn't you make a good living doing that?
I wonder if I could spam that service.
What's that?
I wonder if I could spam that service.
That's great. If you can read this, you need my service.
I love changing an altruistic idea, and they're going, hey, I can totally make bank on that.
What do you consider, Spammer X, what do you consider a perfect spam message? Did I get you on a weird question?
All right, the perfect spam message is sort of a mistake as maybe an email from like your grandmother or your auntie. Someone who's not the most computer literate person in the world, but it sort of looks legitimate. So you sort of click on it. It's not like a subject like 86945, random word. It sort of looks like, hey, hang on, this might be a real email. I might know this person. You click on it, and instantly, this big flashy image pops up, and everything sort of draws you in, sort of alluring, very, very sort of sleek, if you get me. I hate email that's plain text. It's like black on white, and I just look at it and think, that bag was spelled wrong, and everything's trying to evade the spam filters, but it's just made it look really unappealing. I like spam that really draws you in. So I'd say the perfect spam message is the perfect advertisement.
Okay.
It's like the billboard you never forget, or the TV commercial that you go, ooh, I should buy that product next time.
What? That's the other thing about spam messages. I normally, and the spam that I get that actually get through my filters and stuff, it normally is formatted pretty ugly. It doesn't have like a graphical eye. It's got, lots of times there's an image, and the image is either, if it's sent with it, I'll see the image, but if it's, host on another site, I won't see that image, because then I'm telling the spammer that I actually exist. But in general, the graphics I see are pretty poor, kind of boring. I mean, when you send out spam, do you try to make it pretty? Have you ever hired an artist to kind of, target or fine-tune your marketing?
I don't need to hire an artist because I am an artiste.
Oh, that's convenient.
I try and make my spam as sort of graphically appealing as possible. When people see it, I spend a bit of time, just sort of thinking about what grabs people, what sort of drives people a bit. And I did it really well for a few porn sites where I would have sort of alluring poses and nothing like full frontal nudity. I mean, it's not even like R-rated, but just enough that sort of drags people in, if you know what I mean? Like a look in the eye or just something, something about it that pulls people in. That's really where the money in spam is, when you're not necessarily the best person at sending out email and sending trillions of emails out to people, but having email that is effective. Being the perfect marketer.
Well, okay, let's get into the effects of spam. Lots of times these big lawsuits come effect on spammers because there's this perceived notion that spamming costs companies billions and billions of dollars. What do you think the effect of the spam industry has had on companies, on prices, on costs for consumers? I mean, you've got a whole chapter in the book entitled The Real Cost of Spam, and I'm sure that you'll have to flip through it to remember all the numbers and everything. Yeah. But can you give me an idea of what you think about it?
There's a lot of published figures and a lot of statistics that make spam out to be one of the most expensive things on the internet. Everyone really likes to push spam as the evil. But I really don't think that's true. To the average home user and to the average person who receives spam, spam has no financial cost to it. Short of an annoyance and maybe 5-10 seconds of your time, spam doesn't really cost most people.
Okay. Well, let's leave it at that for just a second. We got a call from Santa Cruz. Jane, welcome to GeekSpeak. What's your question, Jane?
What different things let...
Please turn your radio down.
Sorry. Yeah. What are the different things that let a spammer know that it's a good address besides responding and saying, remove me?
That's a good overall question, how to keep your address safe.
Spammer X, you want to help us?
Yeah. Well, I'll hang up.
Okay, thank you very much for the call.
Yeah.
All right. If someone sends you spam, and let's say in the body of the spam message you have an image, as you said before, I guess when you view images in your email, when you view spam, you turn off all images? So you don't download the images?
That's right, yeah.
You said you're right, yeah.
Yeah.
If you download these images automatically, basically the second you click on an email, a spammer that is set up will know instantly that your account is valid. Because the URL which the image is called from usually has a tag in it or some marker that identifies that this is your email. So then they've verified that not only is your email address deliverable, but you click on spam. And then maybe sometimes they're one step further than that, where they can track you as to whether or not you clicked on it, but then maybe you went in and bought the product. So there's sort of...
That's a really good customer, of course.
Yeah, very, really, really good. I mean, to the point that I'm sure would rival like Amazon in terms of how people are watched and their statistics and really knowing, okay, these types of people not only click on my spam, but these types of people buy my spam, or these types of people complain about my spam. This is a really good one. When people start complaining about spam, you know that they not only get the message, but they click on it, and they're active or intent enough on reading it and then complaining. So there's like an additional thing behind them.
Right. We're actually out of time. Gray Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Gray Wolf Computer Systems offers a custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. We've been talking today with fictional character Spammer X, the author of Inside the Spam Cartel, Trade Secrets from the Dark Side, available by Syngress Press. If you're interested in how the spam industry works, if you want to try to love a little more than you hate, go ahead and pick up the book. Thank you very much, Spammer X, for joining us today.
Thank you. No problems at all. Have a great day.
Thank you, too.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening to KOSP and to GeekSpeak. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Ardo, or on the web at kosp.org. Coming up next is Open Road, and at 1 p.m., Two Steps in the Blues. Here's NPR.